Thank you for downloading this episode of New Books in Sports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. For each episode of the podcast, we choose an interesting new book on some area of world sport, and we talk with the author. My guest for this episode is Charles Fountain, Associate Professor of Journalism at Northeastern University in Boston. Chuck is the author of two previous books looking at the cultural history of American sport. One, a biography of iconic sports writer Grantland Rice, and the other, a history of baseball's spring training. He returns to baseball with his new book, a history of one of the sport's most notorious and influential episodes, the Black Sox scandal. The book is titled The Betrayal, the 1919 World Series and the Birth of Modern Baseball, published in 2015 by Oxford University Press. As a historian and teacher of journalism, Chuck is especially interested in how the scandal of the World Series fix was presented in the press of the times. One particular episode he addresses in the book, and in our interview, is the origin of the famous line, "Say it ain't so, Joe," directed from a young fan to White Sox player Joe Jackson. We also discuss in the interview the broader context of gambling and baseball, and how rumors of a fix surrounding the World Series were nothing new or unusual at the time. Chuck is an engaging writer who has crafted a vivid picture of baseball and the gambling underworld of the early 20th century. I think you'll enjoy my interview with him. My guest this week on New Books in Sports is Chuck Fountain. Chuck, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So typically we start out by asking our guests to give a bit of background about themselves. I'll ask you to talk about your background in sports and journalism and what led to your interest in researching sports history.
Well, I think my interest in sports history and my interest in sports have sort of always been a part of me. I was one of those kids that read those, juvenile biographies of great athletes.
I did too, yes.
I've always had that sort of fascination with history, and I think that's been one of the great appeals to baseball to me is the game's history. So it was natural that I would look to that when I was looking for writing projects. The two earlier books were on Grantland Rice, that I had a first book on a guy named George Frazier, who was a jazz critic and a Boston columnist and a magazine writer in the 40s and 50s. But my second book was on Grantland Rice, which gave me a chance to look at the history of American sport in the first half of the 20th century. And then after that, I wrote about baseball spring training, which was a project that didn't get me any sympathy at all when I was leaving on reporting trips in February and March, leaving Boston to go to Florida and Arizona. But that too was a lot of fun. That was a piece of baseball history that I knew very little about until I started getting into it, and I realized that the reason I did was because nobody had written about it, and I felt somebody should. And as to this project, that like every other sports history fan, I read Eight Men Out. I read it when I was a teenager, and it had, was a relatively new book. And I read it, I liked it then. I read it again when I was writing about Grantland Rice and writing about Grantland Rice's coverage of that 1919 World Series. And I liked it then. It was a, very rich book. But as I learned a little bit more about it, I learned that there were some things that were left to be said, what I've been saying is that anybody who writes about the Black Sox scandal owes a great debt to Elliot Azanoff and Eight Men Out, because he kept the story alive all these years. But we also labor under a great burden because he kept the story so alive that the mistakes in that book have become a part of the history, and they shouldn't be. So there was the sense that, there were still things left to say, and the ability to put the story in a greater context than Eight Men Out or any of the previous histories that the book had done.
Well, I was going to ask that. So what did you find in the course of your research that that is incorrect from the conventional narrative, from those who know the book Eight Men Out or the film Eight Men Out?
Well, you know, the two most dramatic incidents in the book and later in the film that was made from the book, I think, are Eddie Cicotte being, you know, outraged at being denied a bonus by Charles Comiskey, mm-hmm. which he had been promised for winning 30 games, and then denied because Comiskey held him out of the rotation in the last weeks of the season, so he would not reach 30. That was the linchpin in Cicotte's involvement in both the book and the film. And there's just no historical, you know, sourcing for that. That if you look at Cicotte's salary card in the Hall of Fame, there's no mention of any bonus on his card. Not in 1919, not 1920, not 1918. That, you know, there are no bonuses on any of the White Sox players' cards there. And, you know, I don't know how many bonuses there were on any salary structures back then. And it was, you know, an exceedingly rare provision. And there was none with Cicotte. Moreover, Cicotte was not held out. He pitched right up till the end of the season. He pitched last four or five games before the end of the season. And he wasn't needed to pitch in those last couple of games because the White Sox, it wasn't his turn, but the White Sox had clinched things and they were setting things up so that Cicotte would pitch the first game of the World Series. So there was just no historical precedent for that. It was not mentioned anywhere else. It was not mentioned by Cicotte in a very forthcoming confession to Comiskey and Comiskey's lawyer just before he confessed to the grand jury, nor was it mentioned in his grand jury testimony. It was not mentioned anywhere in the voluminous history. The only place that it was mentioned is in Eight Men Out, which leads me to conclude that the source for it was Elliot Azanoff's imagination. He made no bones about writing this book in dramatic fashion, that he had originally conceived of it as a screenplay, and indeed his first treatment of the book was as a first treatment of the story was as a screenplay. And he frankly admitted that the other dramatic scene in the book was a fiction, and that's the threat that Lefty Williams received the night before he was to pitch the eighth and what turned out to be the final game, where the thug threatened him not only with harm to him, but to his family as well. That, again, is another dramatic point. Azanoff admitted to creating that character, that, you know, he didn't admit to the threat being a fiction, but he did admit to creating that character, and he had a very strange defense of it. He said that it was to protect himself against plagiarism.
And so not only in looking at correcting some of these myths that are not based on, as you said, on any sources, you also found some new evidence, right, for your book?
Well, there were two archives that have been around for, one of them has been around for a while. The other one is relatively new, at least in historical terms. But they haven't been, I think, fully exploited in the telling of the Black Sox story. The first of the archives is the relatively new one. That is in the Chicago History Museum. And it was acquired by the History Museum in 2008. They bought it at auction from an anonymous donor. You know, there have been people that speculated that they came from the files of the Comiskey estate because they showed up shortly after Charles Comiskey III passed away. But they were originally a part of the files of Alfred Austrian, who was Charles Comiskey's attorney, the original Charles Comiskey's attorney. And what these files show was the extent of Charles Comiskey's involvement in covering up what he knew. He effectively knew that seven of his players had been compromised in that series the day the series ended. And he had actually gone to Alfred Austrian's office that day, and what the two of them discussed was, we need to find out what is out there for information, not so much that they could dismiss the players if they found them to be complicit, but so that they could determine whether or not this story was going to blow up and whether or not they could get away with signing these players for the 1920 season. So Comiskey hired a team of private investigators to follow not all, but most of the players involved in the 1919 fix. And what he determined over that winter was that there was no smoking gun, that it was unlikely to blow up. And so he determined that he could just continue. He could sign these players to their 1920 contracts, and the whole thing was probably going to stay just a rumor. The other thing that that archive showed was how central Comiskey was and Alfred Austrian, his attorney, was in bringing Judge Landis into the game. And moreover, they showed that the reason they wanted to bring Judge Landis in was not to have a new strong voice that would be the center of power in the game, but so that they could take power away from Comiskey's mortal enemy, Ban Johnson, who was the president of the American League and was also the strongest voice on the three-person National Commission during those years. And he effectively had control of the National Commission, and he and Charles Comiskey hated one another. And, that was the reason Comiskey, used that moment, the confusion after the Black Sox story broke, to help him try and bring ruin to his great enemy. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, the other very valuable archive, which is in the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown and is part of the files of Ban Johnson, showed how Ban Johnson was using the same moment to effect the ruin of his great enemy, Charles Comiskey. That Johnson used the full finances and resources of the American League to aid the Cooks County State's Attorney in the months after the indictments of the players, that Ban Johnson effectively became the investigative arm of the Cooks County State's Attorney Office and found the witnesses that were the star witnesses at the criminal trial, persuaded them to testify, brought them to Chicago, introduced them to the investigators for the state's attorney, and put them up and paid their expenses while they were in Chicago waiting to testify. So those two files revealed, I think, a to this point not told piece of the story, which was the extent to which the enmity between Charles Comiskey and Ban Johnson determined how those events after the story came out would play out. Had those two men not hated one another, I think it is very unlikely that the story would have played out the way it did, and also very unlikely maybe that the story would have ever come out, because the grand jury, which is the catalyst for bringing the story out, was really convened only after the presiding justice of that grand jury, Charles McDonald, contacted his friend Ban Johnson and asked, would it be in your best interest, my best interest. Ban Johnson wanted to bring Charles McDonald into the game as the new chairman of the National Commission. And McDonald asked him, would it be in our best interests to have the grand jury look into this? So the grand jury might not have even looked into this were, again, it not for Johnson and Comiskey's, very unpleasant relationship.
I would add that it wouldn't have happened if they were still friends, because they as you talk about the book, they were friends at a time.
That's right. That, dislike for one another was the absolute opposite of how that relationship began. They were great friends. They worked very closely together in revitalizing the Western League, and they were restless as minor leaguers, and they wanted to make their Western League, the major league, which they did. They realigned some franchises, brought them into bigger cities, and in 1901 declared that they were, at this point, no longer a party to the national agreement as a minor league and would be a second major league from that point forward. They were so successful at that, of course, that they forced the merger with the National League within 2 years. They were partners in bringing that to pass, and they were great friends for probably another 10 years after that. They shared an office in the Loop in Chicago and vacationed together, sometimes stag, sometimes with their wives, and that sort of disintegrated for reasons that are rather lost to history. We have some, you know, small events that precipitated the beginning of the dislike, but, you know, how it grew to what it was, we'll probably never know. It's one of the many mysteries of the Black Sox story that we'll never know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if they, following up on your point, if they had remained friends, this all would have likely been, as you say, Comiskey and his attorney would have found out about it and then probably continued to cover it up. But you make the point that this the Black Sox scandal ultimately was good for baseball because of the context in which baseball was operating, in which gambling was just a constant presence around the sport. So can you talk about that context that you discuss at the start of your book of the presence of gamblers mixing with baseball players really since the mid-19th century?
Yeah, but I think that, you know, starting to answer that with the Black Sox, that if Comiskey and Johnson had been friends, that would have been covered up and that would have remained forever, you know, one of those points that historians debate, was the 1919 World Series fixed?
Yeah.
Because we never would have had proof. And if that had been the case, I think we probably would have had another scandal at some point in the next 5 to 10 years. Because, as you said, gambling and baseball were, you know, very closely intertwined in those years. They had been since the beginning. That the number of fixed games in the early years of the game probably rivaled the number of honest games. I mean, that's a slight exaggeration, but only a slight exaggeration. That there was a word that was known to all baseball fans in that era, and we're talking now about the 1870s, 1880s. The word was hippodroming. Mm-hmm. You'll be hard-pressed to find it in a dictionary today, but the few dictionaries that have it will tell you that it means the playing of a contest, the result of which has been prearranged. And it was a very common word in the 1870s, and baseball fans would have known it and would have used it and would have seen its presence in a newspaper story and known that this story was about another game where the outcome was very suspicious. Baseball had sort of tamped that down in the 1880s and 1890s, but once the American and National Leagues merged in 1903, it sort of re-entered the conversation, and it became ever more prevalent and ever more common in the years after that. And the reason for that was because the National Commission didn't want to deal with it. Mm-hmm. The National Commission knew that the rumors of game fixing were bad for the game, but they also knew that if they went digging and proved those rumors to be true, that could potentially be devastating to the game. So what they did was just sort of brush aside the few instances where a manager would bring a player before the league president or before the National Commission and accuse that player of game fixing. The National Commission would always find insufficient evidence and effectively stuck its head in the sand during all these years. And so the gambling became ever more, the relationship between the gamblers and the players and game fixing became ever more commonplace. Because the players looked at these incidents, they looked at players that were brought before league presidents and not disciplined, and they said, well, why shouldn't we do it? There's nothing going to happen even if we get caught. We're probably not going to get caught, but if we do, there's probably not going to happen because look at what, you know, has not happened to other players that have been brought forward. Mm-hmm. So that the 1919 World Series was not an aberration. It was It was an inevitability in the climate of that game.
Mm-hmm. You do tell the story of one player in particular, Hal Chase, and how he's somewhat, I would say, representative of how the National Commission before the 1919 World Series, how they would handle rumors of players fixing games.
Hal Chase was, I say in the book, the Babe Ruth of ballgame fixers.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, when it comes to talking about people who may have been suspect when it came to throwing games, Hal Chase is so far set apart from the rest of them that it is really Babe Ruth and everybody else. That it was estimated that he may have been a part of throwing several hundred games in his 15-year major league career. He was never convicted, of course, of throwing even a single one. But people that he had played with said that, you know, several dozen times a year he approached other players, or he had plays that his teammates suspected were, you know, aimed at pleasing people who may have bet on the games and may have paid him $100 or a couple of $100 to do it. If the National Commission wanted the, you know, to prevent the Black Sox scandal from happening, it had its opportunity. That twice Hal Chase was brought before the National League president. Once in 1910 by his manager of the Highlanders, that was the American League president. And then again in 1918 by Christy Mathewson, who was then managing the Reds when Chase was playing for them. Had either of those occasions resulted in the disciplining of Chase or the dismissal of Chase, you never would have had a Black Sox scandal, because Chase was a star of the first magnitude, and if he got himself thrown out of the game, then other players would have been very wary about engaging in the same type of behavior. But Chase was one of the bigger stars of the game, and the people who ran the game were very reluctant to discipline and bring embarrassment down on the game by disciplining one of its biggest stars.
I want to ask another part of the background, Chuck, that I found interesting, and that's the First World War and its effect on Major League Baseball. And this is stepping back somewhat, but how does this play into the story of the Black Sox?
It played in it in an awful lot of tangential ways. The game was, in a very uncertain state in 1917, 1918, that there was a work or fight order in place, which the federal government said that everyone of draft age, which was 21 to 30, which was about 75 to 80% of Major League Baseball, everyone of draft age had to either work in a defense-related industry or fight, serve in the armed forces. And it was uncertain to Major League Baseball whether they would even be able to operate in 1918. And a number of players took jobs with defense industries where their job was to play for the factory baseball team. And Joe Jackson was one of these, and Lefty Williams was one of these, and a number of other, Major League players were playing for factory teams in 1918. In other words, they had left their Major League team at some point and were playing for these factory teams. This was a real threat to Major League Baseball, that, you know, Major League Baseball was not the corporate Goliath that it is today. It was 16 guys, varying degrees of wealth, some very wealthy from other businesses, others having only the money that they got from ticket sales, that were trying to get by. And the reserve clause meant that they could get by paying their players as, little as possible, and very little, it turned out. And the defense industry could, the factory teams could pay these players almost whatever they want. They weren't bound by the reserve clause. If factory baseball caught on, if there was a fan base that developed for factory baseball when the major league players started playing for it, it was entirely probable that those factory teams would continue after the war and continue to lure those players with the promise of higher salaries and off-season jobs. Everyone had needed an off-season job in those days. So what this meant was that the players were sort of embarrassed and punished when they came back to the game in 1919, that embarrassed in the sense that the owners referred to them as slackers and questioned whether or not they would even bring them back, somebody who lacked the patriotism to fight and instead would take sanctuary with a defense industry baseball team, was a fairly common plight of owners. And Charles Comiskey said, "I don't even know whether I want these guys back on my team if they wouldn't stand up and fight." And really what that was a public negotiating ploy for offering these players depressed salaries in 1919. The other piece of the 1919, or excuse me, the World War I story that had ramifications for 1919, is that Ben Johnson made a great number of horrific missteps. And that sort of weakened him, as you know, he was called the czar of baseball in those years. And all of the missteps that he made through the World War One period weakened him, and effectively allowed Charles Comiskey to put together this coalition of owners, National League owners, completely, you know, a unanimous core of National League owners, and himself and two other American League owners. The missteps by Johnson during the war allowed Comiskey to put that coalition together.
So let's set the plot in motion, Chuck. How did the scheme to fix the World Series start?
We're never going to know the answer to that question. And anyone who tells you differently is, ignoring the evidence. That the players were talking about it throughout the latter part of the 1919 season. That every one of the players that talked about this afterwards, either to Comiskey's private investigators or to the grand jury or to Comiskey himself when they confessed, every one of them said that, the subject came up sort of tentatively a couple of times during August. Buck Weaver actually told the private investigator that the first he had heard about it was June, long before it was clear the White Sox were going to be in the World Series. The talks got, more and more regular and more serious as we moved into the last 2-3 weeks of the season. There were a number of talks that we know about that took place when the White Sox were in New York in mid-September, when they were in Boston in mid-September, and then there was a meeting on the last weekend of the season, the last Friday night of the regular season, in Eddie Seacott's hotel room in the Warner Hotel, where seven of the players were present, and the sort of final, together with two of the gamblers who were trying to put the fix together. And that was where the whole thing finally coalesced. So if you want a starting point, you can probably take that Friday night meeting on the last week of the season. That's as clear a starting point as we're ever going to have, because from that point forward, the fix was in place.
Mm-hmm. And something I got a sense of from the book is that this was never really a well-kept secret. Is that accurate?
No, there were rumors all over the place. And, the Hotel Sinton in Cincinnati, which was headquarters for the White Sox and for the, writers and the official Major League traveling party and such, the lobby of that hotel the night before the first game, looked like the betting windows at Belmont Park, that, it was just crowded with people openly exchanging money, shouting out the odds, and the odds were dropping, that they had been heavily in the White Sox favor, and by the evening of the night before the first game, they were almost even money. And then after the White Sox lost that first game, they shifted to Cincinnati's favor. But all of these, rumors were a part of the environment of a World Series. That, in other words, the rumors in 1919 may have been a little louder, a little more persistent, but they were the same rumors that were there in virtually every World Series that had ever been played.
Mm-hmm. So then what led Comiskey, as you said earlier, Comiskey on the day after the series, he was looking into finding out if his players had fixed the series. So what led him to take action then?
That was Gleason coming to Comiskey. It was, Gleason convinced that, off of all he heard, we don't have any of the particulars, but off of what he put to the players and what the players said to him, that Gleason was convinced that, Gandeel, Joe Jackson, Swede Risberg, Pap Felsch, Fred McMullen, Lefty Williams, Eddie Seacott were all compromised. Those were the seven players. No one suspected Buck Weaver during the series, and Comiskey never suspected Buck Weaver. That Buck Weaver was brought into the story when the players started confessing and included Weaver in the conversation. When I say that he knew that, you know, knew for certain, I'm not sure anyone knew for certain or anyone wanted to fully believe it. But the story as it came out, the seven players that were involved and, you know, the money that they had been paid, that was the, you know, the story as it came out a year later was the story that Gleason and Comiskey believed on the eve of that, on the end of that World Series.
Mm-hmm. So you had mentioned earlier that Comiskey, along with his attorney, they had private investigators, correct, following after the players in the off season.
They did. You know, from you know, early November through the last investigation lasted through the winter into the start of the next season, actually.
Yeah.
And trying to determine whether or not these players were, you know, exhibiting a sudden wealth that couldn't be explained any other way, or, you know, were in any way talking about what had happened. And, you know, the reports all came back that no, they were not, that they were living pretty much the same life that Hap Felsch bought a new car, Chick Gandeel had bought a new home, but he claimed it was mortgaged, that, you know, Swede Risberg's mistress had a new, you know, nail care business. But, you know, there was nothing that, you know, would indicate that these players had suddenly come into an enormous sum of money and were spending it recklessly.
Yeah. So who were then the players that broke? And why did they break and admit that they had been in on the fix?
When the grand jury in the fall of 1920 began looking into baseball corruption, and they took up the case on an entirely different matter. There was a late-season game between the Cubs and the Phillies that the Cubs had been warned was crooked. And the Cubs took that matter to the grand jury and said, would you please investigate this? And the grand jury, again, I said earlier, Charles McDonald was the chief justice of that grand jury, and he was someone who aspired to be the new chairman of the National Commission. And so he took up the matter. And then when writers started saying, as long as the grand jury's looking into this Cubs-Phillies game, why don't they explore these rumors that we heard last fall? So while this was going on, and the early witnesses were not very helpful, they were writers talking about what they knew, but also insisting they didn't believe a game could be fixed. They were, you know, executives that felt they didn't believe that anything had been fixed. The investigation by the grand jury really wasn't going anywhere until a Philadelphia newspaper article that was basically an as-told-to article written by a guy named Billy Mahard, who was one of the fringe players in the previous year's fix, in the 1919 fix. That he and a guy named Bill Burns, who was a former major league pitcher who knew Chick Gandeel and some of the other White Sox, tried to put together what was already being put together by somebody else. So they lived on the fringes of this fix. And in this article, Mahard said that, yes, the game was fixed. He was present at meetings where, you know, the fix was discussed, where owners were, where players were paid. And that sort of blew the lid off, that this was the first time anyone who claimed any direct involvement in the fix spoke publicly. And that obviously became national news, and that was going to mean that the grand jury's hearings took a dramatically different turn. And this was when Comiskey and Ostrand sort of seized control of this, that if you know, the players are going to be indicted, then we've got to be the people that are, you know, doing the investigating here. And they brought in Eddie Seacott, first of all, because they felt that Seacott, and it was Gleason, we believe, that, you know, said that Seacott is the guy that we should speak to first. Because Seacott was bearing the shame of this more heavily than anybody else, that he was not the same person in 1920 that he had been in 1919. So they brought Eddie Seacott in, and indeed he broke, and he confessed to his part in the plot, to getting the $10,000, and confessed fully before Comiskey and Ostrand, and then confessed before the grand jury a couple of hours later. Next was Joe Jackson, who had indicated an inclination to confess what he knew as early as the 1919 World Series, that, you know, he had tried to see Charles Comiskey the morning after the series before he went home, and the speculation was that he wanted to see him to confess to what he knew and what his part in the 1919 series fix was. So he was the second guy in. Same thing. Austrian, Comiskey's attorney, offered him a grant of immunity, which Austrian had no authority or power to do, but the players, thinking that Austrian was acting in their interest, believed him, and they confessed to Austrian and Comiskey and then went over to the grand jury and repeated their story to the grand jury. Lefty Williams came in the next day and told the same story. Those are the only three players that confessed. Hap Phelps talked to a newspaper reporter and told effectively the same story, but he never testified before the grand jury.
Mm-hmm. So something that was interesting to me is we talked about Hal Chase earlier is and one thing I loved in the book are the portraits you craft of the different characters, and you really bring them to life well. And something that was striking is Hal Chase, this serial fixer, was a completely amoral character. He did not care one whit if somebody found out that he was fixing games. Whereas with Seacott and Joe Jackson, you find that they were really burdened by the guilt of what they had done.
Yeah, they were. That, I think if you look to the people who would not have borne this heavily, you've got Chick Andeal and Swede Risberg.
Mm-hmm.
But, the rest of them were burdened by it.
So one of the key elements of the Black Sox story is the quotation from this young fan, young boy, "Say it ain't so, Joe." And one thing I really enjoyed in the book is how you investigate this particular quote, as in particular as a historian of journalism. So what did you find with that?
Well, the story is in Hugh Fullerton's article in the Chicago Herald and Examiner the day after Joe Jackson confessed to the grand jury, that as Fullerton tells the story, that Joe Jackson left the courthouse. There were a crowd of people on the courthouse steps because this story had, made the rounds that the White Sox were confessing. And as Joe Jackson left the courthouse, one little urchin, as Fullerton described him, came up and grabbed on Jackson's coat sleeve and said, "It ain't true, is it, Joe?" And Jackson replied, "Yes, son, I'm afraid it is." And the little boy said, "Well, I never would have thought it." And that was the genesis for the, the famous "Say It Ain't So, Joe" line. The story was reprinted and widely reprinted in newspapers across the country, but the line became not "It Ain't True, Is It, Joe?" but "Say It Ain't So, Joe." Reporters in those days were such that even when they were stealing a story, they couldn't get it right. There's been a lot of debate about whether or not this actually happened, that nobody else heard this, nobody else reported it that first day. It was Fullerton's and Fullerton's alone. And so the consensus of history is that that Hugh Fullerton made this up. My take on this is that it really doesn't matter whether he made it up or not. Look at what that story tells us. But in those three lines is the entire Black Sox story as it hit the American consciousness. There is, hurt, betrayal. There is the little boy's loss of innocence. There is the American hero stripped of his aura and dignity. There is the, the puzzlement and the mystification over, how it could possibly have happened. It's the entire Black Sox story. It's a Shakespearean tragedy there in three lines. That it doesn't matter whether he made it up or not, that's the story right there. That's the reason it's endured, because those three lines are, that's the capsule story of the Black Sox scandal and the public reaction to it.
Well, my next question follows closely from that, and you talk about this in one of your later chapters in the book. The Black Sox, and particularly Joe Jackson, have had a lasting place in our culture. Why is that, do you think?
Because it's baseball's eternal mystery. That, we started our conversation talking about how Baseball fans are fascinated with history, that history is a piece of the sport, that we sit in the games and we compare what's going on now with what happened before, be it yesterday or last year or 100 years ago. And that so we are fascinated with history as baseball fans. And this piece of history is a piece that we're never going to resolve. It's baseball's eternal mystery. And it has proven itself insoluble over these 95 years. And the story is never going to crystallize. We're never going to have a full idea, because the truth of the matter is that there never was a clear picture. That I think if everyone who was involved had any firsthand information, had sat down and told their story fully and completely the day after that series ended, we still would have had 40 different versions of the story, because nobody knew what was happening, because it was ever shifting and ever changing, and the players didn't know who was in and who was out, who was trying and who was not, and it was something that never had clarity, so it's not surprising that it lacks clarity this far out. But in striving to give it as much clarity as we can, we remain fascinated by it. The fact that we'll never fully understand it makes us want to, plummet as deeply and as clearly as we can, so that we can understand it as fully as we can. Every little advance is a triumph.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you then, we're almost out of time. Let me ask you a couple questions that get at the heart of the mystery, given that you've been working on this for years. Did the Black Sox lose the series on purpose, or did the Reds win the series?
I think that, that Eddie Seacott and Lefty Williams were compromised in those first two games, particularly Williams in Game 2. I think after Game 2, the White Sox were trying to win the series. But the fact of the matter is that they were so psychologically, distraught, confused, all the rumors were so inside their head that they couldn't have played their best baseball, during those weeks under any circumstances. The other piece of this is Cincinnati played beautifully. Mm-hmm. Cincinnati got outstanding pitching in that series from all four of their starters. And, that's one of the things that's lost in history, that, people have asked, called the title of the book is The Betrayal, Who Was Betrayed? And I say, well, everyone, if you were a piece of this, you felt betrayed. But nobody felt more betrayed than the Cincinnati Reds, and they felt betrayed by history, because they were convinced that they were the better team on those 8 days in October. And I think they were probably right. I think they probably were the better team on those 8 days. And they were convinced that they were deserving of far more from history than their role as accidental champions.
Mm-hmm. So the other question that gets at to this mystery of the Black Sox is, of course, should Joe Jackson be in the Hall of Fame?
Well, what I wrote in a piece, a few weeks ago, when Rob Manfred declined to reopen the Joe Jackson case and consider the petition that people had put to him for Jackson's reinstatement, I think Joe Jackson is better off outside the Hall of Fame. We put Joe Jackson in the Hall of Fame where he unquestionably belongs off his playing record. We put him in the Hall of Fame, he becomes one of 325 men in the Hall of Fame. And maybe his story with an ending, however happy the ending might be, maybe we put the story aside now. That story is finished. But if Joe Jackson stays on the outside looking in, he remains this iconic, mythic American figure of popular culture, the guy who is people literature like The Natural and Shoeless Joe in the decades since his death. But more importantly, I think he keeps this conversation alive of, how do we balance mercy and responsibility? How guilty were these players, and how deeply and for how long do they pay for what they did in 1919? And how do we incorporate this this stain and scandal into our history? And I think those are all, fascinating questions and relevant questions and conversations to keep having.
Mm-hmm. Chuck, I want to finish with the questions or the arguments that you pose at the beginning of the book in the introduction, and that is, what do you see as the legacies of the 1919 World Series and the Black Sox, not only for baseball but for American sport?
I think the perception of the legacy is that if you cheat, you're going to get caught. Maybe not immediately, but eventually. And, you know, so that cheating isn't going to pay, and it is in the pure and best interests of sport to play the game as it was intended and as we believe everyone is playing it. You can look at the steroid scandal, and you can believe that because the steroids users have been caught and in many cases punished, even if punished by being, you know, excluded from the Hall of Fame. Or you can take the cynical view and say people are always going to cheat, and look at, you know, 95 years after the Black Sox, ball players are still cheating, still trying to get an edge. So I think that, you know, that the legacy is that human nature remains very complicated. And that is what makes the game and following the game, you know, ultimately so very interesting, that it's played by, you know, humans who possess skills that most of us can only imagine, and yet, you know, they are still human, and so they have failings and flaws that sometimes undo what their great gifts have allowed them to achieve.
You've been listening to an interview with Charles Fountain about his book, The Betrayal, the 1919 World Series and the Birth of Modern Baseball, published by Oxford University Press in 2015. New Books in Sports is part of the New Books Network, which offers dozens of channels of podcast interviews with the authors of new publications on subjects like religion, politics, biography, popular music, and more. Go to newbooksnetwork.com to find the subjects you're interested in. If you like what you heard here, please follow us on Twitter at New Books Sports, or friend us on Facebook at facebook.com/newbooksinsports. I'm your host, Bruce Berglund. Thanks for listening, and enjoy your week.